सार्थ्यमर्जुनस्यादौ कुर्वन् गीतामृतं ददौ लोकत्रयोपकाराय तस्मै कृष्णात्मने नमः। हरे कृष्ण। वेलकम बैक टू द भगवद्गीता भक्तिशास्त्री कोर्स। वी आर नाउ इनटू द 8th चैप्टर ऑफ द भगवद्गीता, द लास्ट सेक्शन। सो लेट्स हैव अ क्विक ओवरव्यू ऑफ द 8th चैप्टर बिफोर वी मूव फॉरवर्ड। सो वी डिस्कस टिल नाउ how in the 8th chapter there are several sections. The primary focus is on remembrance of Krishna. So we discussed how first Krishna answers Arjuna's 6 questions till verse 4. Then the 7th question is how to remember Krishna at the time of death, is from 5 to 8. Then remembrance by Yoga Mishra Bhakti. Then remembrance by Shuddha Bhakti. Then the remembrance by comparing natures of material and spiritual worlds. And then remembrance by Bhakti Yoga is easier than by Ashtanga Yoga. That is the concluding section which we will discuss today, 23 to 28. Now let's look at this, the 23rd verse. Yatra kale tvanavrittim avrittim chaiva yoginaha prayata yanti tam kalam vakshami bharata shabha. So, yatra kale tvanavrittim. So, what is the time at which anavrittim, one will not come back? Avrittim chaiva yoginaha, and one will come back. Prayata yanti tam kalam vakshami bharatarshabha. So Arjuna, I will explain to you the time at which if the yogi departs, the yogi will return, and the time at which if the yogi departs, the yogi will not return. I will explain this to you. Vakshami bharatarshabha. So now Prabhupada explains that if the yogi is perfect, he can select the time and situation for leaving this material world. But if he is not so expert, his success depends on his accidentally passing away at a certain suitable time. And now Prabhupada also quotes something interesting over here. According to Acharya Baldev Vidya Bhushan, Sanskrit word kal here refers to the presiding deity of time. So here we are going into foreign territory, in the sense that what Krishna will be discussing over here involves a lot of preliminary Vedic knowledge which we are not familiar with in the normal course of our Krishna conscious study. So I'll talk about, so this is basically what Krishna will talk in the next verses about the two Vedic paths called Devyan and Pitrayan. So I'll discuss about those two paths, but before that let's discuss a little bit more about the path of yoga. Now see, every particular path when a person follows, there is a worldview associated with it. So but for example, when a person wants to be a materialist, then there's a particular worldview associated with materialism. That may be godless materialism, or that may be pious materialism, religious materialism, or atheistic materialism. But there's a worldview associated with that. So say if there's a godless materialist and the worldview is that there's no God, there's no soul, and this life is a competition, as is survival of the fittest, and we have to fight to enjoy in this world, and whatever a success we get in this world, that is the only success and happiness that we will have, and when we die everything is finished. This is a worldview like that. Now in many ways a worldview is like a map. A map helps us in some ways to navigate territory, but if the map is wrong, then we cannot really navigate the territory properly. If I am traveling in Mumbai and I have got the map of Calcutta, then no matter how much I try to go follow the map, I just not make any headway. So first of all, I have to have a correct map. But then even if a map is correct, the map may not be appropriate for me. What does it mean? See, there is a difference between correct map and appropriate map. If I want to find my way in a city, and for that I have got a map. If I am looking at if I have got a map which is primarily talking about geographical features, you know, where there is plateau, where there are plains, where there are rivers, where what is the kind of soil that is there, where there are fault lines under the soil. If that kind of topographical features are the primary focus of a map, then if I am in a city trying to find the house of a friend, that will not be helpful for that. Now that map is not incorrect. That map will be correct, but it is not appropriate for me. So, the map which we have should not only be correct, but it should also be appropriate. So, now in the Vedic culture, there are multiple correct maps that are given. But not all are appropriate for our spiritual advancement in Kali Yuga by the practice of Bhakti Yoga in Krishna consciousness. So, the process of yoga has a particular kind of map. What is that map? That map involves, like we discussed yesterday, the various chakras are there. And these chakras help, this is one particular way of looking at the body. So, now if we look at it from a scientific perspective, we may say, oh, actually if I study the science, it just talks about glands and it talks about circulation and talks about nerves and blood and such things like that. There's no concept of chakra there. So again, it's a different map. To understand this concept of a map, we have to understand that the focus, when we look at a particular worldview, what we can know depends on what we know. What we can know depends on what we know. That means, if a car is giving a strange noise while driving, an ordinary person may think, oh, why is this car giving this strange noise? It's irritating. But a trained mechanic may say, oh, there's some problem in its carburetor. Or maybe there's some other technical problem in some other part because of which it's giving the problem. So now, because the mechanic already has certain knowledge, because of that, when some further stimulus, some further information comes up, then one is able to understand it better. So what is just an irritating sound for ordinary driver is a sound that indicates what is wrong and what needs to be corrected for a mechanic. So what we can know from a particular situation depends on what we know. So in the modern scientific way of looking at the body is primarily seen as a biochemical system. It's an organism, but it's basically a biochemical system. So essentially the whole functionality of the body is considered to be based on the proper balance, circulation and integration of its biochemicals. So chemicals refer to substances that we study in chemistry. They are natural and conscious substances. And biochemicals refers to substances that are studied in biology, that contribute to life, or living systems to be more precise. So biochemicals, it's basically a system of biochemicals. And all diseases are seen to be caused by some anatomical or physiological dysfunction. So anatomy refers to internal structure and physiologically refers to internal functioning. So when there's a fracture, there's an anatomical problem. That may also lead to when there is indigestion or something like that, when there's low blood pressure, when there is anemia, that's largely physiological. So either way, the point is everything in the body is seen from a biochemical perspective, a structural, the structure, it may be structural also problem, but ultimately structure is also comprised of biochemicals of different kinds. But this is a reductionistic view of looking at the world and at the body. Ayurveda has a different way of looking at the body. Ayurveda focuses on seeing the body in terms of kapha, vata and pitta. So now, kapha can be compared roughly with, kapha is basically referring to the solid content in the body. Vata refers to the air content and pitta refers to the heat content. It's a rough correlation. And in Ayurveda, the idea is that when kapha, vata, pitta are balanced, then the body will function effectively. And when kapha, vata, pitta are in imbalance, then the body cannot function properly. So now it's a well-known experience fact that people do get cured by practicing Ayurveda also. And people get cured by doing Ayurveda allopathy also. Now, of course, some devotees may choose allopathy, some devotees may choose Ayurveda. Prabhupada preferred Ayurveda, but Prabhupada was not fanatical about it. Prabhupada was pragmatic. Use whatever works. So, the point is, both are maps, and both maps look at the body in a particular way, in a distinctive way, and they try to solve the problems that are there in the body. So how do we reconcile these two maps? We understand that it's the same body, but depending on the framework with which one is looking, one will see the body differently. Now, even the allopathic person will recognize that there is some heat in the body. Now, we know that the body temperature is important. If the temperature goes up, it indicates that there is fever, and that indicates something wrong inside the body. So, the concept of heat in the body as connected with health is accepted in allopathy also. But the whole point that there are certain substances which generate heat, and the concept of Jatharagni as bodily resistive fire itself, that may not be so directly understandable for allopathy. But there can be rough correlation. Now, whatever are the organs that are talked about, whether it's allopathy or Ayurveda, you know, there is a kidney which has certain function, there is a liver which has certain function, heart has certain function. There are certain things is similar, but the way of looking at the two is different. So, both work in their own way. And both focus on trying to take care of the body. Now, Ayurveda, it doesn't just it certainly talks about material, physical balance, but it also takes into consider psychological and spiritual aspects. Not all Ayurvedic physicians may necessarily talk about God and soul, but if we study the original Ayurvedic scriptures, Ayurvedic books that are there, they do talk about the mental and the spiritual aspect also. Although that is not their emphasis, it's a medical book, but that is mentioned over there. So, just as this Ayurveda offers one way of looking at the world, now because science is largely reductionistic, so even when Ayurveda offers medical benefits and heals, it's considered one of the alternative treatments which is quite successful in many ways. But still people are suspicious because we have been brought up in a particular worldview. So, we may not be able to appreciate Ayurveda easily. But just as Ayurveda works, although there's a different way of looking at the body, similarly, there is another way of looking at the body, which in some ways connected with Ayurveda, some ways different. That is the yogic way of looking at the body. It involves seeing the body in terms of its energy centers. So, let's understand this. We will see first of all how even in science, there are different ways of looking at the body. In terms of, not in terms of allopathy, but in broad understanding of what the body is. Let's look at it. So, the point which I was making of there being different maps. You know, here we will see the same human body, but depending on what is the focus, we will see that the body will be seen differently. Now, if I want to focus on the nervous system, this is what I will focus on in the body. Now, if I want to focus on the cardiovascular aspects, the respiration and other things like that, then this is what I will focus on. If I want to look at what are the internal organs, this is the viscera, this is what I will focus on. If I want to look at the lymphs, then this is what I'll focus on. So what does this is? Now if we look at it, you know, if we were to just look at each of these separately, we would think that these are quite different. So they are different and yet they are connected also. How they are connected? Because they are all talking about the same body ultimately, but when there is a different focus at that time, we will look at the body in different ways depending on the specific focus. So, what we want to do in a particular territory will determine what kind of map will be most appropriate for us. So now, just as there is one way of looking at the body in terms of the physical functions, similarly, there is another way of looking at the body in terms of energy fields. So, this might seem a bit eerie or scary, but there's nothing apprehensive about it. Actually, this is talking about the energy fields. Now, what do we mean by these energy fields? Actually, we'll see over here. First, there is a shape around this person, and then further rays are going out. This is like a aura of the person. And here we will see, basically, energy fields that are around the person. So this is energy radiating outwards, this sort of the aura, the shadow of the person, and this is the overall field that are around a person, the energy fields. Let's understand this a little bit more now. See, even according to modern science, the whole universe is filled with vibrations. And everything that we do, it sets off vibrations. Right now I'm speaking, so this is sound vibrations. But even without speaking, if I move my hand, the movement of my hand, it creates, it sends off ripples in the air around me. That also creates vibrations. Just the movement of any object, that also sets off vibrations. And anyway, there are vibrations which are constantly there. The whole system of, say, telecommunication is based on electromagnetic vibrations. So we call people by cell phone and such similar things happen because there are vibrations which travel around. So, just as a person needs to have some understanding of physics to know electromagnetic vibrations, electromagnetic waves, and to tap into them, to utilize them. Similarly, we need other aspects also. What do we mean by other aspects? By other aspects, what we mean is that there are other ways of looking at the world, at the body also. So, when we talk about Vedic culture, we broadly talk about the three modes of material nature. So that is also one way of analyzing, especially the psychological characteristics of things. The modes don't determine only psychological characteristics, and they have a wide-ranging effect on everything. And we will discuss about the mode later when we come to the 14th chapter. But here, we all know about the modes, and broadly we know, okay, this behavior isn't goodness, this behavior is passion, this is ignorance, whichever way it might be. But the important point in all cases is that we work primarily on the on the map that we are using. You know, depending on how I look at the world, accordingly I function. So, in the process of yoga, the purpose is that one has to channelize one's energies. And what are these energies? These are psychic energies. These are subtler energies, not physical energies. So, there is some nascent research that is happening in mapping auras of people. Many times we see in, say, Amar Chitra Katha or in some movies, if you see some saintly people, we'll see some light around them. It's called a halo. So, it said that they give out an effulgence. It may also be called as an aura. So, now, if we have the appropriate technology, we'll find that every person has an aura. Every person has some kind of vision around that person. What is this aura exactly? That aura refers to the kind of effect the person has in the environment that one is around. Sometimes we'll find that if we go in the presence of very advanced devotees, then just by being in their presence, we feel calm. We feel spiritual by that. Now, sometimes it may happen even when we go to a temple. Now, we just go in the temple, outside it may be a rush, and there is honking, and there are crowds, and there is pushing, and there is so much. Just enter the temple atmosphere, and suddenly we feel something different. Oh, it's so peaceful. What is making me peaceful like this? So, what is it that makes us peaceful like that? Actually, it is something which is very distinctive. Now, even materialistic people, when they go to temple, they feel this. That these vibrations here are different, they say. Now, what is it that makes them feel peaceful like that? Actually, it is the presence of spiritual vibrations. It is the presence ultimately of Krishna. Now, materialistic people may, when they don't have proper understanding of deity worship, they feel that, okay, this place is spiritual. They don't think necessarily the deity is spiritual, that the deity's presence is there. Actually, the chanting of Hare Krishna, the glorification of Krishna, the prayers and the meditations the devotees have done over there, all those create vibrations which help in creating a spiritual setting. So the important point is to recognize that wherever we are, there are vibrations around that. So this vibration need not be just physical vibrations, or the kind of vibrations that are studied in physics. There can be subtler vibrations also. So the energy fields refer to the kind of vibrations that we set off in a subtler level. Science in and of itself doesn't study everything that we know about. There is much that is beyond the scope of science as it is studied today. Even emotions are difficult for science to comprehend, or to speak of things beyond that. So this is another way of looking at the world. And in the path of yoga, it is understood that these energy fields that we have, these energy fields can be maximized or minimized for our benefit and for others' benefit. So when we say that the certain yogis, when they advance in the study of yoga, they can get siddhis. So what is a siddhi actually? When the yogis get some siddhi, what exactly happens? You see that when we can get access to subtler or higher dimensions, then we can do things which are not so easily possible in lower dimensions. For example, if I'm in this room. Now, if, say, assume this is a small room, and if I want to go from the right top corner of the wall to right top corner of the room to the left bottom corner of the room. So from one end to the other end. Now actually, if I can travel diagonally, I can go like this. If I don't travel diagonally, if I have to go just like this, then first I'll have to come down, then an ant will have to climb down like this in the vertical dimension, and then move horizontally and come here. But if there is a mosquito that is flying, the mosquito will just fly from here to here. So it has access to, because it has capacity to fly, it doesn't have to stick to the ground. So basically the point is, the diagonal decreases the distance and enables one to go faster. So similarly, when there is the access to higher dimensions, then that which is not normally easily accessible becomes easily accessible. So even in science, there is a concept called as wormhole. What is this wormhole? You know, in most science fiction movies or science fiction novels, there is the hope of space travel and travel to distant planets where there are other kinds of life forms, and going there and staying there. That kind of things fascinate people. So when they're talking about such things, so at that time, how are these things done? What is the practical way in which these things are done? They are done by the practice of certain things, certain concepts, what they call it wormhole. So the idea is that Einstein has proposed that space-time is like a circle. So now currently space travel is limited by the upper limit of the speed of light. So if one cannot, if we just go by the speed of light, then what happens? Then some stars are said to be thousands of light years away. So what does it actually mean? It means that when we see a star in the sky, if it is a thousand light years away, that means we are not seeing the star as it is. The light from the star, it took 1,000 years to come here. That means we are not, when we look at the sky, we are not looking at the present, we are looking at the past. We are seeing the star as it was 1,000 years ago. And even if we go at the speed of light, we will go there after 1,000 years. And who knows, the star may have exploded and it may not be there only. So, actually, space travel in science and science fiction, it is limited by this upper limit of the speed of light. So therefore, the scientists have thought of a concept called a wormhole. That means, if space-time is like a sphere, then normally one has to go like this from the top of the sphere. One wants to go from one end to the other end. But if a worm has to go, a worm can make a hole. And they just go into the hole, and just, instead of going all around this, or on the circumference of the sphere, you just go right through the, in a diagonal line, and just in a radial way from one end to the center, and then through the center to the other end. That will be much shorter. So that is called as a wormhole. So now, of course, wormhole right now is entirely a concept, and whether wormholes exist and whether space-time is actually spherical and whether one can find the areas where wormholes are possible and whether one can travel to a wormhole, all these are speculations right now. We don't know what it is. But the point which I'm making through all these examples is that by access to some different kind of reality, our normal way of functioning can be changed. It can be, things can be expedited. So, for example, when there is prapti siddhi. Prapti siddhi means what happens? See, somebody, Prabhupada will also say that, you know, he met yogis. If somebody wants a date from Kabul, that yogi will be sitting in the room and suddenly the yogi will stretch his hand and right now the dates will appear and give you the dates. So now, in many cases, people who claim to do this are just doing magic. They have dates hidden somewhere and they just connect it and they mislead the people and they show the dates. So yes, there are people who are magicians who do these things, but along with magicians, there are also other people who do it genuinely. They are capable of doing it. So how do they do that? Actually, when the yogis, by the development of their process of, development in terms of subtle energies, they can access subtler dimensions. When they access subtler dimensions, they can then travel faster. Not just faster, but they can take shortcuts that are not accessible to those who exist in lower dimensions. So Zaput Prabhu and Srila Prabhupada, scientist disciples, and he has talked about this in several of his books, and there are Vaitiji articles also which talk about this. Diagrammatically, he also explained these things. We are not going to go into technicalities here, because our focus is not Vedic science, our focus is Bhagavad Gita here. It's certainly not yogi science. But the important point is, when we have access to subtler dimensions, the things which are not possible with normal means are possible by access to those dimensions. Just like if one is working on a computer. In a computer, there can be multiple levels of users. So some users, they just have access to the basics, you know, just data entry. But other, somebody the more advanced user, that person may be given access to not just data entry, but you can look at the code also. And you can change the code if it is required. And some user may be like a meta user, the biggest user. Person has access to everything. So even a simple machine, we can arrange system in such a way that depending on one's level of authority, one's level of responsibility. In Sanskrit, this level of responsibility authority is called as adhikar. So depending on one's adhikar, one will be able to do things differently. So therefore, one will be able to get access to more things and will be able to do more things that way. So yogis are those who tap their subtle powers by a certain process. And when they do that, then they are able to have some siddhis also. Now if you look at the Yoga Sutras carefully, even in the yogic path, the siddhis are considered to be distractions. They are not the ultimate goal. Because ultimately siddhis, many people think siddhis are spiritual, but siddhis are not spiritual, they are material. Why? Because the siddhis are focusing on material things. It is the ability to manipulate matter. So, and the ability to manipulate matter is ultimately material. But in the chakra system, so there are subtler energies. So, first point I made is that chakra system is a different way of looking at the body. It's a different map. And in this map, the subtler energies. When we tap those subtler energies, then we can do things which are normally not possible because we get access to higher dimensions. The word dimension we use here is not exactly identical to the way in which we use it in science. But even in science, when we talk about string theory especially, it talks about 11 dimensions, 17 dimensions. And scientists themselves talk about higher dimensions. But how those dimensions can be conceived is something which even the scientists can't understand or explain properly. But there is a concept of higher dimensions. So the Vedic understanding of higher dimensions is not exactly similar, but it is something which is in that direction. So the basic point is, when one's subtler energies are activated, and one has access to higher dimensions, then one can do certain things at that time. Let's come back to this now, this concept of energy fields. So once one understands the concept of energy fields, so we discussed this chart yesterday. Now, Let's look at the, I mentioned about chakras, Anuja chakra, the human chakra system. So here this is described in the Vedic texts. Now there are, now we talk about chakras, and in the scientific understanding there are the various glands that are there. So here's the correlation between the two, a rough correlation. It doesn't have to be. So now the Mooladhara chakra, that can be roughly correlated with adrenal glands. The Swadhisthana chakra is correlated with gonads. The Manipur accordingly with GIS and pancreas. The Anahata with thymus. The Vishuddha with thyroid and parathyroid. The Agya with pituitary. And the Sahasra with hypothalamus and pituitary. So, now each of these chakras have certain hormones associated with them. Not the chakras, the glands have the hormones associated with them. So basically what we are trying to do over here is, what this chart explains is, that these two systems, it's not that one is scientific and other is unscientific. You know, they can be correlated. But because the worldviews underlying them are different, so there can be some differences also. But both within their worldviews, they stand intellectual scrutiny. And there is possibility to access power. So just as when we study science, so the doctors who have studied the physical body extensively, they have power. You know, the ordinary person doesn't know what to do, why there is pain in my stomach. And the doctor knows, and the doctor may give some injection or does some surgery, and the pain goes away. So just as this knowledge gives us understanding of the body, which gives some power, similarly, the understanding of the chakras also is a kind of knowledge which gives power. So this is this correlation with metabolism. Now after understanding this, basics of the yogi system, the purpose of understanding these yogi systems is, the whole principle in yoga is that it is focusing a lot on material. It is not, the ultimate aim is spiritual, the focus is quite a bit on material. Regulating the breath, sitting in a particular asana, and then trying to activate the chakras, and then to get the prana to rise to the highest chakra. Now in all this, the focus on remembrance of Krishna becomes substantially lowered. And that is unfortunate. So if somebody can focus on remembering Krishna, and by remembering Krishna one returns back to Krishna, that is the best. But if one doesn't focus on Krishna, then that can lead to problems. Because one relies too much on one's own endeavors, and if one's own endeavors don't work out properly, then one will not be successful. So now with this understanding, the material factors. So the material factors are quite important in the path of yoga. Because the path of yoga doesn't rely primarily on the grace of the Lord. And it doesn't take shelter of transcendental bhakti. It focuses on material readjustment, redirection of the bodily energies. So therefore, at a material level, adjusting things at the time of death becomes important. Krishna has said earlier that one who remembers me will come back to me. But for those who do not focus on that devotional injunction, just remember me, for them they have to do other things. What are those other things? That will be discussed in the next verse. Let's look at this verse now. Agnir Jyotirah Shukla Shanmasanuttarayanam Tatrapayata Gacchanti Brahma Brahma Vidojanaha. So Agnir Jyotir Aha Shukla. Agni is fire, Jyoti is light, Aha is day, Shukla is the white fortnight. We have Shukla and Paksha, and so this fortnight refers to the phases of the moon. So Shukla Paksha and Krishna Paksha. Shanmasa Uttarayanam. So we know that from the point of view of the earth, the sun, depending on the way the earth's angular tilt is, 23.5 degrees, the relative position of the moon, the relative position of the sun. So there is Uttarayana and Dakshinayana. Sun appears to be moving, the whole celestial arrangement seems to be moving toward the Uttara or the Dakshina, depending on. So Tatra Prayata Gacchanti. If one goes away during that period, Brahma Brahma Vido Janaha. Then such a person is Brahma Vido, and such a person attains the Brahma. So then Krishna says that they attain, Prabhupada says that they attain the Supreme. What happens? They attain that Supreme. So Prabhupada also makes the point over here. When fire, light, day and the fortnight of the moon are mentioned, it is to be understood that all of them are, that over all of them there are various presiding deities who make arrangements for the passage of the soul. So now this is, Krishna is not talking about devotees over here. Krishna is talking primarily about yogis. See, what is going on in this chapter is a comparison of the path of yoga and the comparison of path of bhakti. Yoga refers to Ashtanga Yoga. So Krishna recommends it's easiest as the fixing of the mind on him. But he also analyzes the path of yoga, and his goal is to compare and establish how bhakti yoga is easier. So here, when he's talking about the process of yoga, he's describing how the yogis depart. So when the soul departs within the path of yoga, it's described in the Vedas, that in the Shrutis primarily, that there are various devatas who supervise the pathways that are used by the departing soul. Just like, you know, if a person is going in a train, then there are different railway stations along the way, and there are station masters of each railway station, and they overall look after the rails over there and the passage of the trains over there. So similarly, when we go after death, after that when the soul departs, then how the soul goes, which pathway does the soul takes, that is determined by certain, that pathway is overseen, different parts of the pathway are overseen by the presiding deities. So here Krishna, when he's referring to day and night and Uttarayana and such light and such things, this is referring to not just this particular phenomena, cosmic phenomena, but it's also referring to the deities in charge of those phenomena. That means, when a person is Brahmavito, when a person knows the absolute truth, and then one has one's consciousness such that one has propitiated these particular deities, and those particular deities guide the person along the path ultimately to Brahman. The focus is taking the soul ultimately to Brahman. That is the focus. And how is that focus fulfilled? That is by purification. So yoga also involves some level of purification. And yogic austerity brings about purification, the requisite qualification. And then the yogi goes along in that way. So now, if the yogi is not so advanced, then the yogi does not, then these particular presiding deities don't guide that person. What happens? Then another set of deities guide the person. That, who are those deities? That is described in the next verse. Dhumo Ratri Satha Krishna Shanmasa Dakshinayanam Tatra Chandramasam Jyotir Yogi Prapinivartate. So there is a different path. When one takes a Devyan, so Priyas was talking about a Devyan path. Yana means path. You know, we have, and nowadays there are missions, you know, which are made Chandrayan or Mangalayan. ISRO is setting up missions like that. So they say, we want to go to the moon, we want to go to the Mars. So the idea is that Devyan is a particular path which ultimately leads to liberation. Pitrayan is another path which leads to heavenly planets, but it doesn't lead to liberation. So here it is, this case, Dhumo Ratris Tatha. So here what happened? Dhumo Ratris Tatha Krishna. So Dhumo is smoke. Dhume Navriyate Vahanir. We discussed this earlier in 3.38. How one of the ways the soul is covered by lust is meant, this is lust. Smoke is covers fire. Like Ratri, night is Krishna. So here Krishna doesn't refer to Krishna. It refers to the dark portal. You know? So Shukla and Krishna Paksha. The fortnight of the dark moon. Shanmasa Dakshinayanam. So as contrasted with Uttarayan and Dakshinayanam. Tatra. What happens to such people? Chandramasam Jyotir. Chandramasam is the moon planet. And the yogi prapya nivartate. So what happens to the yogi is, the person who goes there, the person as Prabhupada mentions, goes to the moon planet and then lives for 10,000 years according to God calculations and then returns back. Yogi prapya nivartate. This is another path. That means the yogi who has done austerities and who has timed the death at the right time, but not exactly at the right time, so that one can attain liberation. So in that sense, it's the wrong time, but still it's a time by which the yogi gets fruits. It's not that there is zero results. Yogi also gets results, but what is the result? The yogi gets elevated to Chandraloka. That means the yogi goes to heavens, but after staying in heavens, the heavens are not eternal, remember. They will be long-lasting, but they are not eternal. From there, the yogi comes back to the earth. And in that way, yogi prapya nivartate. And Krishna will describe in the next verse. He contrasts the two paths in one verse. Shukla Krishna gati ayete jagata shashvate mate ekaya yatyana vrittim anyaya vrittate punha. So Shukla Krishna gati ayete. So there are two ways of passing from this world. Ekaya yati anavrittim. By one, anavrittim. One will not come back. Anyaya vartate punaha. By another, one will come back. Shukla Krishna gati ayate. So Shukla refers to Shukla Paksha, Krishna refers to Krishna Paksha. So gati is the ways of passing. Jagata shashvate mate. These are the Vedas, which is shashvata, the Guru's opinion. Mate is opinion, shashvate mate. There are two ways of departing. But you know, Prabhupada quotes this from the Baldev Devshan, who is quoting it in his Vedanta Sutra commentary, this is Chandogya Upanishad. Now this whole thing, what he has talked about, Baldev Devshan talks about it in his Govinda Bhashya commentary also, quite extensively analyzes this. And there he explains this, as Prabhupada also quotes it, non-literally, not just these particular times. You know, because if they are just specific times, then there is often an overlapping or a contradiction. Because it means Uttarayan, that is 6 months, but within that we have to have day and we have to have night. So in Uttarayan, in daytime. But what about if there is night in Uttarayan or day in Dakshinayan? So what will happen? There are a lot of complications over here. So literal understanding doesn't really stand the scrutiny if we go in very seriously into it. So he gives an explanation that this is referring to deities and it's referring to Kala. Doesn't necessarily refer to time only. Kala can refer to time, but also refers to path. And there are two paths of leaving the world. And that's the way it is talked about here in this chapter. Ekaya yatya navrittim. By one will not come back, the other one will come back. So the whole point of this discussion is that actually there are a lot of precise factors that have to be taken care of so that one will attain success in one's spiritual journey. And if one doesn't take care of those things, one will not attain success. So how will I take care of all these things? So Krishna tells Arjuna, don't bother about this so much. Naite sriti partha janan yogi muhyati kashchuna tasmat sarveshu kaleshu yoga yukto bhava Arjuna. So sriti is different path. Naite, these two supreme different path. Even if one knows, yogi muhyati kashchana, the yogi is not muhyati, yogi is not bewildered. Therefore, what should you do? Tasmat sarveshu kaleshu yoga yukto bhava Arjuna. O Arjuna, practice the path of yoga. Now, what is the practice of yoga? You'll see that in 6th chapter, Krishna has emphasized that ultimately the best yoga is the yoga of bhakti. So when one practices bhakti yoga, one will make the most tangible advancement. One will go rapidly back to Krishna. Yogina api sarvesha madgate nantaratmana shraddhavan bhajate yoma same yukta tamo mataha. Krishna has told in 6.47, at the climax of the 6th chapter, the best yogi is one who remembers Krishna and returns back to Krishna. Therefore, what one should focus on is in the remembrance of Krishna. And yoga yukto bhava Arjuna means, Krishna is telling Arjuna, be connected with yoga. Don't bother about all this. What will happen? Just do what you can. What you can do. And that is, stay connected in yoga. And the yoga that Krishna will recommend ultimately, we will see this. Krishna may not refer directly, explicitly to himself over here. But his general instruction is, actually as contrasted with Devyan and Pitrayan, and the whole processes by which one has to time one's departure and go back. You know, it is far easier if one stays in the path of yoga, and the best way of staying in the path of yoga is by connecting oneself with the absolute truth in devotion, the personal absolute truth. That means by practicing devotional service, by remembering Krishna. So Prabhupada writes in the purport, and Prabhupada told elsewhere also, that a devotee doesn't have to worry too much. Sometimes we have fear that I'm trying to practice Krishna consciousness and I'm trying to remember Krishna, but what if I die suddenly in an accident, or die suddenly when I get a heart attack and there's no one around me, and what if I don't remember Krishna at that time? What will happen then? So, a devotee should not be afraid of these things, because Krishna is there and Krishna will take care of the devotee. In the Baldevdevin quotes in his Govinda Bhashya that actually he quotes in, I think, from the Vaman Purana, and he says, you know, Krishna loves his devotees so much that Krishna gives his remembrance to his devotees. And no matter what the material circumstances be for a devotee, Krishna helps the devotee to remember him. So we may not be able to remember Krishna, but Krishna will remember us. Krishna will remember the bhakti that we have performed, and based on that bhakti, he will give the result. So devotee, in traditional Vedic culture, there is the concept of a good death and a bad death. So, you know, there are various concepts like that. If somebody dies suddenly, somebody dies and at that time, at certain times, it's considered unholy. So in many traditional societies, in traditional Vedic society, you know, people, when they have to die, they will leave the world. How will they leave the world means? They will leave their cities, wherever they are staying, and they will go to Kashi, or they will go to Vrindavan, and they will say, when they are going only, you know, their relatives and friends will come to meet them, and they know that this person is now departing, and is not going to come back, this person is going to die, and their relatives will come, and they will offer obeisances. I'm not talking about devotee families, this is actually, it's been observed in traditional Vedic families also, that, you know, it's not that the person is going to commit suicide after going to that place, but the person decided, now my life is coming to an end, I'm going to die. So then, there are centers like that where people can go and stay and focus exclusively on cultivating remembrance of Krishna and doing devotional service. So when they go, then other people come and beg forgiveness. If I have offended you in any way, please forgive me. And then there's a tearful last meeting, and then the person leaves. So the idea is, in the Vedic culture, it's recognized that one should prepare oneself to remember Krishna. And the holy places offer one of the best possible settings for remembering Krishna. So, we should not, when Krishna says here, yogi naite sriti yogi muhita, that the yogi is not bewildered, that does not mean that we should just rely only on Krishna's guarantee. Oh, Krishna will take care of me, I don't have to do anything. No, we have to do something. What is that we have to do? We also have to, as Krishna says in this verse, yoga yukto bhava arjuna. We have to stay connected with Krishna. If we are diligently doing our devotional service, then we don't have to bother. You know, how does the exact moment of death will come? What will happen to me when I die? No, I don't have to bother about that. But what I have to do, what I have to bother about is, how am I doing what I can do? See, when we do what we can do, Krishna will do what we can't do also. But when we worry about what we can't do, we can't time our death. We don't have control over that. But when we do what we can do, Krishna will do what we can't do. And in that way, there will be human-divine cooperation. So, yogi, don't be muhyati Krishna. Just focus on Prabhupada's experience. A devotee chant Hare Krishna and stay fixed in the process of Krishna consciousness. And without bothering too much about death, you should keep practicing. We see the example of Srila Prabhupada, that Prabhupada was actually elderly. You know, he was 69 when he retired from his household life. When he decided to embark on a journey to America. So when he decided like that, at that time what happened? Actually, when he decided like that, it was not, he was in Vrindavan, and he could have stayed on Vrindavan, and just chanted Hare Krishna and departed ideally. But he wanted to do more than that. So he didn't want to just himself depart ideally. He wanted to bless everyone else with Vrindavan's blessings. And that's why he went all over the world and preached. So he brought the knowledge of Vrindavan, the glory of Vrindavan, the love of Vrindavan to people all over the world. And then he helped them to come back to Vrindavan or to the Vrindavan consciousness through cultivation of Krishna consciousness. And then at the end of his life, he returned back. Now, Srila Prabhupada, he wanted to instruct his disciples of how they should pass life's final exam. And that's why he came by their side. And he had them by his side and he stayed in Vrindavan. But Prabhupada often said also that, I'll be happy if I can die like Arjuna, fighting. I can, of course, Arjuna did not die, but Arjuna kept fighting. I want to keep fighting for Krishna. And if fighting for Krishna is a privilege, and if I die while fighting for Krishna, that is also auspicious. So Prabhupada had that spirit. So as devotees, you know, we orient our life in such a way that as we grow older and older, then we can intensify our devotional service more and more. But overall, the focus in our practice is not just the, not only just preparation of death. Our focus is more of development of love. And when we develop love for Krishna, other things are automatically taken care of. We'll be able to remember Krishna here. And that Krishna will assure in the next verse. Videshu yajneshu tapahasu chaiva daneshu yat punyafalam pradishtam atyeti tat sarvam idam viditva yogi param sthanam upaiti chadyam. So Krishna is telling over here that whatever results one may get by other paths, Vedeshu, by the study of the Vedas, Yajneshu, when one does various Yajnas, Tapahasu, one does austerities, and then Daneshu, one gives charity. So generally in the Vedic culture, Yajna, Dana and Tapa, these three are considered to be primary religious activities. And of course, study of Vedas is important. So Krishna, we will see in the 18th chapter also, Krishna will talk about Yajna-dana, tapa, karma, pavanani, manishinaha. That Yajna-dana karma is such that it can purify even the people who are manishinaha, who are quite advanced, who are pure, who have controlled the mind. Manishina, manaisha. So Yajna-dana, tapa are considered important. But Krishna is saying that these are dharmic activities. They are not necessarily transcendental. Even on the path of transcendence also, we may do some yajna, we may do some tapa, we may give some dana. But in the path of transcendence, our focus is different. Our focus is on Krishna. Our focus is not just on doing our dharmic activities for the sake of gaining punya. So, but Krishna is telling that whatever activities you may do, Krishna, the previous of Krishna says, just be yoga yukta. Just be yoga yukta. So one may wonder, if I'm just yoga yukta, then what about yajna dana tapa karma? Krishna is telling that no. Whatever results you will get by that, yat punya phalam pradishtam, all this will give you punya phala. But Krishna says atyeti tat sarvam. Atyeti tat sarvam. Atyeti means more than that, beyond that, superseding or surpassing that. Atyeti tat sarvam. So whatever results one gets by all the other all these things, vedeshu yajneshu tapahasu daneshu, one will supersede that, surpass that, and idam viditva. If Arjuna, you understand this and you practice it. Yogi, in addition, what will happen? Param sthana mupaiti chadyam. Yogi will attain the param sthana. So here Krishna is telling that the focus on transcendence will give us a far greater result than what can be got by doing activities for material punya. So in this way, in this chapter, Krishna shifts Arjuna's focus decisively from acting in the world to acting for the goal beyond the world. And now, what kind of yoga there is to be practiced? Krishna has mentioned the word Sulabha in 8.14 or remembrance of him. But in the 9th chapter, Krishna will describe this further. What is the means by which one can get this result? Param sthanam. And 9th chapter is Rajvidya Raj. It's called the king of knowledge, called most confidential knowledge, Prabhupada translates that. So there it's clearly talking of bhakti yoga. So this 8th chapter concludes with a call to practice yoga. Now here yoga doesn't necessarily always have to mean Ashtanga yoga. What it mentions is focus on the transcendental goal and stay connected to the transcendental goal. So Prabhupada's purport is beautiful over here. It's progressive purport. So Prabhupada summarizes the Vedic process over here. He says that how a brahmachari practices brahmacharya ashram, lives, and then a person gradually moves forward. And then Prabhupada writes, study of the Vedas is not meant for the recreation of Arjuna's epictetus, but for the formation of character. So when one studies the Vedas under the master for a period of from 5 to 20 years, so that means in his brahmachari life, a person becomes a man of good character. And then one comes into grihastha ashram, and then one retires from grihastha ashram, and then one moves forward to sannyasa. But then Prabhupada says, the beauty of Krishna consciousness, however, is that by one stroke, by engaging in devotional service, one can surpass all the rituals of the different orders of life. That means, essentially what Prabhupada says is that this progressive yagyadan tapa karma which is done in the Vedic pious life for doing punya, the ashram, brahmachari, grihastha, vanprastha, sannyasa which are embraced, all these are good, but they are progressive. However, if one gets bhakti, then it's one step up. One can quickly move forward and in one stroke get the result of devotional service. By engaging, that is the supreme result of life. One will get love of Krishna, one will get param sthanam. So, it's like when a person gets $1,000,000, then $5, $10, $100, $5,000, all of them are included within that. So like that, one gets this param sthanam, the love of Krishna, then everything else that is there, it is automatically included in that. And then Prabhupada says that one should begin by studying the Bhagavad Gita from a devotee. So one should learn Bhagavad Gita from a devotee and not from mental speculator. This is a sign of faith. And Grovali Prabhupada describes how we study the Bhagavad Gita and the doubts disappear and love for Krishna eventually emerges. And the param sthana upaitchadam, Prabhupada said, this highest perfection stage of life, what is that? Completely in love with Krishna. What is mentioned in the previous verse? This is the highest perfection stage of life. And when we are completely in love with Krishna, enables the devotee to transfer to Krishna's abode in the spiritual sky, Goloka Vrindavan, where the devotee becomes eternally happy. That is the ultimate goal. So, in the 8th chapter, Krishna tells Arjuna that yes, there can be material adjustments, and by different kinds of material adjustments, one can get different material results. And by this, onerously, one can gradually even attain Brahman. But the best by staying fixed steadily in yoga, one can get the result of the other paths of Yajna-dana, other activities of Yajna-dana tapa, and beyond that, one can get the transcendental result also. Therefore, stay fixed in yoga. And how the best yoga is Bhakti Yoga. That was mentioned in the 6th chapter and that will be reiterated in the 9th chapter, which we will discuss in the next class. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.